so I've got this device, Cargill, and what you do is you strap it to your back and it makes you fly. It's going to be amazing.
But it's made out of plastic.
I know. It's not quite as durable as steel.
That's not just those are Diet Coke bottles.
Right. But the rocket fuel that I'm going
to
put into...
Is that a tube of Mentos?
Yes. See, here's
what's going to... God damn it, Brian.
It's going to work!
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Cinema. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast on filmschoolrejects.com that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury. I surprisingly did not kill myself with that Mentos and Diet Coke rocket experiment. Did not end up dead, which is always good.
You can't get those pants back ever, but...
No, I didn't like those pants, though. They're totally fine. And joining me yet again, as you well know, my friend and co-host, a screenwriter, a novelist, a lieutenant in Megaforce... Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
And we lied to you fine
lied.
People.
Lied.
Because
by we, you were using the royal
yeah,
we.
Yeah, we being Junk Food Minima. Junk Food Brian. We are not taking the month off because fuck that. We want to talk about movies and there's no way that we can't talk about this particular movie. Now, we don't have a theme for the rest of the month. We're kind of just shooting from the hip and going with some random movies. Although, you know, I've been polling people on Facebook, and it seems like they really like it when we do kind of the more random off-the-cuff things. So,
well, it's weird, because like when we do the random off-the-cuff things, we're like, yay, do lots of random stuff. And then when we do theme months, they're like, yay, we love the theme months. So apparently they just like what we do.
The internet is impossible to please, is what I'm getting from that, and I am not surprised to hear it. That being said, I'm very excited to talk about this week's movie, which we're going to do after I do a little bit of housekeeping. Just want to let you know that you can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Please follow us. Tell your friends to do the same. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And please use our Amazon links whenever humanly possible, because we do get a kickback if you buy anything from Amazon via those links, not just the thing that we are linking to. So yes, that's all the housekeeping stuff. And now let's get into this week's movie, a movie that has been a favorite of mine since I was a wee boy.
A movie so old that there is 90s porn of it.
That's true. That's very true. Is it the Cocketeer?
It is the Cocketeer.
Please tell me it's the Cocketeer.
Of course it's the Cocketeer.
Of course. See, if it were made too much, you know, after the movie came out, then it would just be called Rocketeer XXX. Because there's no creativity, there's no grasp of puns anymore in the naming of pornography, and that is my biggest problem with the industry.
The days of Schindler's Fist and shaving Ryan's privates are over.
This is what I'm saying. If you take the cleverness and the creativity out of your porn titles, you're just making smut, and I think we should make something that we're a little
American
bit more proud
booty.
Of. American Booty. Thank you.
These
That's
are all
what I'm
real
talking
titles,
about.
By the way.
That's
we're not...
what I'm talking about. That is the America that I want to live in. The America...
The America of the 1990s?
The America in the early
90s. Where your porn was scrambled and...
yeah, I had to watch through...
You had to go into a dirty, seedy, recently mopped place to...
To be fair, when this movie came out, I was 7 years old. So not a lot of porn being watched by 7-year-old Brian, but a lot of The Rocketeer being watched by 7-year-old Brian.
An awful lot of Rocketeer.
It's a rocket. A rocket?
How do I look? Like a hood ornament.
Stand clear.
What was that?
A flying man!
The Rocketeer.
Go get him, kid.
I love this movie unabashedly, and it's one of those films that when I wanted to talk about it for this month, I was a little concerned that it'd be one of those situations where I loved it as a kid, and then upon revisit... started to notice a lot of flaws, the seams showing, a lot of...
Oh, it's not the Phantom.
What happens if it doesn't hold up?
And it's
it
not
turns
the Shadow.
Out, it's not... How dare you? Turns out, this movie is as pristine now and as igniting to my imagination as it was when I was 7 years old. The Rocketeer, from Disney. I hope you've all seen it. If you haven't, I don't know what to say to you.
I would argue that it not only holds up, it's actually much better.
I would agree with that. There are things about it you catch when you watch it, you know, as a little bit of an older person than you did when you were a kid. I mean, as a kid, it was just, ooh, that guy's flying. That's awesome. And, oh, you know, this on a blimp. Like, there's a lot of action. I like the look of it. But there's a lot of specificity to this movie that is kind of insane.
And there's a number of character actors in this movie who at the time were just people doing small bit roles who have then gone on to do amazing stuff, especially amazing TV work that you see in this, and you're like, oh, I love them. And you see exactly what they're doing and how they're doing it and get to really enjoy those smaller characters even more.
Sure. And I'm going to say this, and this may be kind of bold, but I'm going to say it anyway. The experience of revisiting The Rocketeer is not terribly dissimilar, especially in the case of if you are watching this initially as kind of a fledgling film fan and then revisiting it after you've really started doing your homework, it's very much like the experience of watching a Quentin Tarantino movie initially and then educating yourself on film and then watching it again afterwards, because you start to notice all of these weird little things, all these weird little references, all of these weird little homages that you just wouldn't have thought about before. Like, that's what I mean about the specificity of this movie. They are culling from things, as did the comic that this is based on, that are just all over this, all over the map. I mean, in terms of what it is they're actually
referencing. Yeah.
And I love that. Like, Dan Stevens' comic, on which this movie is based, is kind of like pulp potpourri. Like, it combines elements.
Pulpourri,
yes. I mean, he's combining elements and characters from Doc Savage, from The Shadow. He throws in, you know, real world pinups like Betty Page. And then on top of all that, you know, possibly the bedrock of the whole character is King of the Rocket Men, which is a movie serial from the 40s.
Yeah.
So he is pulling from all of these very strange places. And, you know, if you see King of the Rocket Men, you know, this 1949 serial, that has to be the inspiration for the look of the Rocketeer. I mean, you take one look at this character and the helmet alone gives the influence away. But that's what I mean. Like, the more weird stuff you kind of reach outside of your comfort zone and expose yourself to, the more you kind of understand how this movie is composed. And that was the most thrilling part for me revisiting it. It's just noticing, like, all of these little things, and especially the old Hollywood stuff. The old Hollywood stuff in this movie, because it came out in this period of time where all of the superhero movies were period-based films. I mean, as we mentioned, The Shadow, we mentioned The Phantom, we had The Rocketeer.
Yeah, we had this, we in the early 90s, while Hollywood was kind of trying to find its voice, because it you know, as we've talked about before, we had the genre crash of the mid-80s, and then we had this big push towards reality, and then that started to taper off and become something else, and Hollywood wasn't quite sure where to go, and they wanted big blockbuster movies. And, you know, just as the indie boom was taking off, which is where, you know, the reality-driven filmmaking really went to, they started having this nostalgia kickback, and they wanted to get back to, you know, the 30s and the 40s and fetishizing that stuff. And we saw a big push in a few-year window of a lot of things going back to that era and harkening back to that. Almost like one final time, while the people who were young enough to experience it while were still around before they went into their golden years. And it was a really interesting time. Yeah, there's all these really great kind of fetishized movies. And who better to fetishize this era than Joe Johnston?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the movie 100% that leads to Joe. It takes a while, but this is the movie that leads Joe Johnston to direct Captain America First Avenger.
Yes.
Absolutely. And
I'm of the opinion that he's the only person that could have ever done that way.
I would agree. I would absolutely agree. And I want.
Actually, I'll take...
Let me just say, mulligan.
I will say, I think Spielberg could have pulled it off, because Spielberg is in love with that era just as much as Johnston is. Mm-hmm. And I think Spielberg could have pulled it off. But I like Joe Johnston's flair for this better than I may have liked Spielberg's.
But that would have ended... The Spielberg version would have ended with Cliff Secord, like, sacrificing himself to save Jenny and then being like, earn this. And then it would have been... big emotional moment. Credits swells.
And
John Williams
been,
music.
You know, Bucky would have had this terrible, you know, dream with Captain America dying while he's, you know, having an orgasm, having sex with, you know, his girlfriend or whatever, you know.
Yeah. More than likely.
Munich.
I mean, I think we pretty much get Spielberg. I mean, I think that's the one thing to take away from this conversation is that we've been able to bottle Spielberg and we could probably now market it. But I do want to talk about when this movie came out and that the odd trend, it seems odd to us now, of, you know, the characters that were being adapted from independent comic books and comic strips. I mean, The Shadow, The Phantom, Dick Tracy, all of these movies were being adapted from comic strips because Hollywood
Brenda
still...
Starr.
Hollywood still had no fucking idea what to do with superheroes, what to do with comic book movies. And at this time, 1991, the only game in town was Batman, and that had just begun.
Yeah.
The Superman franchise was dead. The only thing that was out there at this point was the very first Tim Burton Batman movie. So Hollywood decides, you know, throughout the 90s that it's going to adapt sort of the also-ran second-tier type superheroes from different sources than traditional comic books. So that's why we get things like The Shadow and we get things like The Phantom and Dick Tracy. But Dan Stevens' comic book is not a classic comic book. It is a comic book that he wrote, you know, in the 80s that was hearkening back to the Art Deco, orgasmic, over-the-top, larger-than-life 40s. And I think, you know, I've thumbed through a few pages of the comic book, and I really do love that style that he came up with. Again, it's very Art Deco, and I think the movie does a great job of capturing that. And like Stevens, Disney at this time really has an affinity for classic Hollywood in the 40s. Like, if you've ever been to Hollywood Studios, formerly MGM Studios, at Disney World, the whole park looks like the Rocketeer set. It is all very 1940s Hollywood, like Los Angeles in that period. And I love that this movie I think that's why it's such a perfect project for Disney and why they and Joe Johnston did such a great job with it is because they have that same affinity that Dan Stevens does for this era. And that's one of my favorite things about it is it reminds me of those Looney Tunes episodes. Even as a kid, I loved more than any other Looney Tunes episodes where, like, you know, Elmer Fudd would be working at the Brown Derby, and then they would just animate versions of the popular Hollywood stars of the time.
Oh, they even have a few of those gags in this movie.
They do.
Where they literally just have, you know, Clark Gable walk by.
Yes. And there's actually a really specific reason for it. That's what's crazy is, like, you could take this movie completely at surface level and enjoy the hell out of it. And then there's also all of this weird historical kind of... alternate timeline, you might say, or playing up of rumors, you know, really dipping into Hollywood lore like you wouldn't expect from a movie that's just about a guy strapping a rocket to his back. But it's
you're talking about Errol Flynn, aren't
I am talking about Errol Flynn.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And we will get into that a little bit more in depth in just a moment. But let's talk about, you know, you've mentioned it already, Cargill. Let's talk about this cast, because this cast is unbelievable. You have this relative newcomer, Billy Campbell, who's playing Cliff Secord, our kind of hunky, charming pilot extraordinaire who finds the rocket. And I got to say, for somebody who really hadn't done anything up to this point in his career and did very little after this, sadly, I think Campbell is amazing in this. Like, I think Campbell is the perfect piece of casting for this role. And when you consider all of the names that, you know, that Hollywood was looking at the time of, you know, people that they wanted to put into this role, the fact that Billy Campbell won out is really kind of impressive. I mean, like, Johnny Depp, for example, was somebody they were looking at to be the Rocketeer. You know,
that would be a very different movie.
Oh, you want, let's continue along the alternate timeline weirdness. Other people considered for this role: Kevin Costner,
I could see that.
Matthew Modine,
yeah.
Dennis Quaid, Kurt Russell,
yeah.
Bill Paxton, Emilio Estevez, and someone with whom Cargill is familiar, Vincent D'Onofrio.
Wow.
Yeah,
it was a little weird for D'Onofrio even then.
Yeah.
See, I could totally see Kevin Costner. I could totally see Matthew Modine, because Billy Campbell is practically cut from the same DNA as Matthew Modine.
Yeah.
Especially in this era. But yeah, some of those other choices are just a little... little bizarro.
A little out there, right? A little out there.
Because what you need for the Rocketeer to work is you need Bill Campbell's aw shucksness.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, the gosh golly, you know, of him. You know, the dunderheadedness of which he treats Jennifer Connelly while being obsessed with his flying, that you still kind of get and adore him.
Right.
That I don't think a lot of the other actors could have brought, especially at that time.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And you know, moving down the cast list, Alan Arkin as his sort of irascible mentor slash the roommate.
With one of Alan Arkin's weirdest accents to date.
Yeah, it is a little strange. He's playing Peavy. He's all kinds of, like, their relationship is very strange. He's kind of Alfred the Butler. He's also kind of the quirky roommate. Like, it's kind of a sitcom situation they've got going on there. And he's outstanding, and he delivers the one-liners. And then you have Timothy Dalton playing the bad guy, playing Neville Sinclair, who is absolutely positively modeled after
Errol Flynn,
yeah. Right down to the whole suspected of being a Nazi conspirator thing, which, yeah. Again,
they take it well beyond even what Flynn was,
yes.
Was accused of.
Absolutely.
But the anyone who was familiar, especially at the time, because this was a big thing, because that had broken in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of those big things. And there were a number of books written about it, about Flynn having been a Nazi conspirator, or at least a Nazi sympathizer. And I had read a couple of those books because I was a big Errol Flynn fan. Mm-hmm. So, of course, when this comes out, it's like, oh, okay, here it is. They're going after Errol Flynn again. But Timothy Dalton makes a great Errol Flynn in this.
He really does. And then on top of that, you have Paul Sorvino as this gangster character, Eddie Valentine. You have longtime Coen Brothers collaborator Ron Polito playing kind of the shifty landlord, the guy that owns the hangar where Peavy and Cliff are, you know, they're training for the Nationals. They want to be champion airplane racers. And then Terry O'Quinn,
yes,
who is himself a well-loved alum of this show for The Stepfather, for a number of other things. Terry O'Quinn playing,
which you'd know as which the rest of you would know from Lost.
Yeah, John Locke.
He was mm-hmm. Locke on Lost.
Yeah.
And once you say that, everyone's like, oh, that guy who gives my favorite performance of Howard Hughes ever.
Yes, I tweeted that. I said, you know, I really love that movie. That movie about world famous aviator Howard Hughes. What was it called? Oh yeah, The Rocketeer.
Yeah.
Because this is the version of Howard Hughes that I want to believe existed in the world. This is the movie that, okay, the whole reason, this is my favorite part of this. The original creator in Dan Stevens' comic of the Rocket Pack was Doc Savage. But Disney could not get the rights to Doc Savage. So who becomes the mythic hero of this movie that creates the Rocket Pack and is the kind of the wizard behind the curtain the whole time? Howard goddamn Hughes. Howard Hughes is the hero of this movie. And Terry O'Quinn plays him with so much passion and so much drive, and you just you love him. Like, you absolutely love this Howard Hughes. And I he's one of my favorite parts of the whole movie, and I love the fact that in a movie called The Rocketeer, about a guy with a rocket strapped to his back, the real hero of the piece is fucking Howard Hughes. I love it. I love it. And of course, we would be remiss by not mentioning the lovely ingenue of the film, Jennifer Connelly, Oscar-winning actress Jennifer Connelly, playing Jenny Blake. She is beautiful. She is alluring. She is possibly the damseliest damsel to ever damsel. Like, she's so inept. Like, this character, if I had a problem with this movie that still kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, it's that character is, like, I don't even, like, I think Kate Capshaw's character in Temple of Doom may be more capable.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
I'm like, after she escapes from the South Seas Club at one point in the movie, for no reason whatsoever, she runs back inside, and then toward the end of the film, she thinks it's a good idea to set off a flare inside of a blimp, and is actually the reason that the fucking Hindenburg is catching on fire. And it's like, I'm sorry, why did you fire that? Why did you do that? And there's so many moments like that where I'm just like, you seem so out of your... And it's not her performance. It's not her performance. It's just what they give the character to do. But it is kind of annoying after a while, I will say. That did bug me a little bit. But it's the only thing that didn't work for me upon revisit. But, and it, you know what? I will take this opportunity, however, to apologize to Jennifer Connelly, because I had heard a story years ago, and I've since dropped it drunkenly at parties because I thought it was hilarious, that the reason that Cliff's girlfriend in the movie was changed from Betty in the comics to Jenny, the story I had heard was that Jennifer Connelly, young in her acting career, kept getting confused when other actors called her by anything but her real name.
Oh, that's very not true.
It is not true at all. It is a hilarious story. It turns out to be as factual as Errol Flynn being a Nazi conspirator. In fact, in the original graphic novel, Cliff Secord's girlfriend was Betty Page, not Jenny Blake, but he based the character on Betty Page. So when
those
it came
of you who
time
haven't caught on, The Rocketeer is essentially a precursor to The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Exactly. So you have all of these characters from other stories and even in this case, real life, other magazines, I guess you could say.
Bumping together.
But Betty Page, Betty Page wouldn't allow her name to be used in the movie. That's why they changed it. It wasn't because I will say it's
at this point she was still alive.
Yes,
and she had left all that stuff behind and become a born again Christian. And
yes,
so she did not like anything referencing her old work.
Well, they started, if I'm not mistaken, doing a little research here, they started work on this movie in the 80s. So she was still very much alive and yes, just did not want her name used in the movie, which is why, they change it to Jenny, not because Jennifer Connelly didn't know that her character and her name were different. Sorry, Jennifer Connelly. I know you've been waiting on that apology for a long time with bated breath.
Now you said we would be remiss if we didn't mention that. We'd actually be remiss if we didn't mention at least one other person, if not two.
Okay.
First of all, one of the patron saints of junk food.
Yeah,
cinema.
No. That's literally the next thing I was going to mention, is that this is probably the score in this movie.
Oh, no, no. I'm not even talking about it. That is a completely different patron saint. But Clint Howard shows up in this.
It's the weirdest thing. He's in one scene.
How is that weird for Clint Howard? That's what Clint Howard does.
But, like, they don't even really, he doesn't really say anything. He whispers in somebody's ear. You don't really see his face. Like, the two things I can always count on with a Clint Howard cameo is you see his weird little face, and he says something weird. And in this case, it's neither. Because he's just like whispering in Neville Sinclair's ear and then he disappears. But yeah, it's like, what was that fucking?
That was Clint Howard.
That's Clint Howard.
Just showing up. And then, of course, there's Margot Martindale who's in this.
Margot Martindale, yes.
Who's
character on. Actress Margot Martindale.
Yes, who many of you would know as having done some really amazing TV work over the last few years.
The Americans.
With The Americans and Justified.
Yeah.
And here she is doing the only gig she could get in the 90s, which is playing, the Ma character running a diner.
A diner shaped like a bulldog. I wish that place was still. Apparently, when this was a real place at one time in California, by the time they made this movie, it had already been demolished. So they kind of just rebuilt it. And I'm like, I want that to be a real place so badly. Like that sums up everything you need to know about the production design of this movie. That there is a diner that plays a key role in the film that is shaped like a fucking dog. And it is awesome. And of course, as I started to say, the score is done by another patron saint, and unfortunately very recently fallen saint, James Horner.
Yeah.
And for me, it struck me watching this movie finally that I figured out why I like James Horner so much. It's that he's the only person who arguably writes better adventure scores than James Horner is John Williams. And that is not a small compliment to James Horner. Like, the only person who I would put in the same league as James Horner in his ability to really create movement in an action sequence and really capture the spirit of adventure on, measure for measure is John Williams.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was just like this eye-opening moment where it was like, that's what he is. He is every bit as good as John Williams at creating adventure scores, and I think this is one of his best. Flurries of strings and horns, like he's a popcorn version of Rimsky-Korsakov, That's a Flight of the Bumblebee reference for all you music nerds out there.
I love this score. I wouldn't call it one of his best, only because saying that puts it up with like some really epic tier stuff.
I would put it with your trifecta. I really would. I really would put it with your James Horner trifecta.
You'd put it up there with Star
with
Trek
Battle, with Khan,
with Aliens,
with Krull. Yeah, I would. I would actually. I would actually put this. I think this is
An American fucking tale.
Yes, with an American tale. And you know what? The swell, the biggest swell, I think, in the movie happens right as the Rocketeer is climbing this observatory. And this is the moment for me where I was like, oh, it is no accident whatsoever that Joe Johnston ends up directing Captain America. Because there's a scene where the Rocketeer climbs the observatory and stands next to the American flag posing hardcore. And I was like, you throw that guy a shield, he's Steve Rogers in a helmet.
Well, you know, that's the thing is watching this movie really does feel like Captain America, like it exists in the exact same universe. Like Joe Johnston doesn't deviate. He did in making Captain America, he didn't feel that he needed to deviate from the Rocketeer in any way, shape, or form. It feels like it's the same goddamn universe.
Yes.
And which is really kind of fucking cool.
Yeah.
Now I just want to say, going back to what you're talking about, that was by no means to disparage the score, which I think is great.
Yeah.
But a great James Horner score, compared to one of the epic James Horner scores is just, that's where I feel this is. I think this is one you can listen to, but it just doesn't like, you don't go, oh, the Rocketeer, and somebody just instantly starts humming the theme.
Well, we're arguing degrees of greatness
exactly.
of James Horner.
That's what I'm trying to point out, is that we're arguing degrees of greatness, not I am disagreeing and saying, no, it's a crap score.
Yeah.
No, it's a really fantastic score. It's really great. But, you know, saying that James Horner's up there with John Williams, absolutely. Some of his scores, I feel, are better than most of John Williams' scores.
Yeah.
I prefer James Horner to John Williams, which I know is sacrilege to most folks. But I feel that James Horner had much more range, although Horner was really famous for kind of ripping himself off, which is part of what I love about him, is that you listen to several of his scores and they sound like other scores, but in the best way, and each are a variation on a theme.
Well, and I think what perpetuated that wasn't even him. I think what perpetuated that is he had the, I don't know if you want to call it distinction or curse, depending on which side of the fence you lie, of working for Roger Corman. So I think while I agree that there's a lot about his scores that can sound similar, another criticism has been lobbied against John Williams as well. While I think that's true, I think what's perpetuated this whole James Horner rips himself off is that Roger Corman took the score for Battle Beyond the Stars and used it in the trailer for like 8 other movies and used it in some of those other movies too.
Oh yeah, no, he copy and pasted it into Sorceress.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's part of the reason Sorceress wasn't able to be released until recently, because there were lots of issues with it legally. But as much as that has something to do with it, you listen to that score for Battle Beyond the Stars and then put on Star Trek II The Wrath of Khan and then put on Krull. And
you got yourself a great evening I'm hearing.
Not only do you have yourself a great evening, you sound a bit familiar. In fact, if you play bits of those soundtracks to anyone but someone like me who has watched all 3 of those films like in an unreal amount of times, they're going to be, oh, wait, which one is this? This is Star Trek, right? No, this is Battle Beyond the Stars. Oh, I know this. This is Battle Beyond. No, this is Krull. Because they sound really fucking similar.
I think there's another thing that makes the comparison to John Williams so apt, too, is because you can, if you do this at a bar sometime with a friend, have him start singing the Indiana Jones theme and then immediately try to make him switch to Star Wars and then immediately try to make him switch to Superman, because it takes a few seconds for your brain to dissimulate those three scores. So I think it's a criticism that has been lobbed against both of them, but I think they are on an equal plane. They can go toe to toe when it comes to creating scores that encapsulate the spirit of the adventure that's on the screen and make you excited to see the next scene.
You know, it just as a small sidebar, if you will.
Sidebar.
John Williams got a lot of crap for the score of Harry Potter being not that memorable and interesting. And 8 movies in, you know, you whistle that theme, everybody knows exactly what the fuck you're doing.
That's pretty hilarious. Yeah.
They were like, this is not one of his best scores. It's not very memorable. And now it's...
I love that score.
And you get, yeah, no, and goosebumps just went on the neck of several people who were like, I love Harry Potter. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's so weird, to see in retrospect, because John Williams gets a lot of flack, and so does Horner, you know, and now Horner won't get as much flack because now he is, as they say, the honored dead.
Yeah.
And,
it's going to be a very sad Oscars this year. Oh, it's going to be such a sad Oscars.
Oh, fuck. No, this was the year, 2015 was the year that it's like, hey, did you grow up in the 80s? Yeah. Nut punch.
Everything you love is dead.
Did you watch wrestling? We're killing all the wrestlers. The ones that aren't dead are dropping N-bombs. Oh, hey, you like movies in the 90s or in the 80s? Here, we're going to kill all your heroes, and we're going to kill the people who made the music for those heroes. It's like, oh my God, stop it. Please, stop it.
You took Nimoy and Horner in the same year, like, you're just...
And Craven.
And, well, I'm just saying,
and
you're
Rowdy
being...
Roddy.
But what I'm saying is you're being greedy about the Star Trek II thing, okay? Yeah. Like, stop taking everybody from Star Trek II that
and
was still
really,
alive.
And Shatner still breathes?
I know. I wasn't going to say it, but it's true. It's true. I want to talk for a second about the structure of this movie, because one of the reasons I think I liked, and I have come to like even more, the sort of offbeat, period-based superhero films of the 90s, is because as much as I like the Marvel movies, there is a pattern, there is a routine that we kind of fall into with them. There's kind of an expected structure to them, and I'm not really knocking them so much as like it's something I enjoy, but one of the reasons that I have a lot of affinity for these 90s period-based offbeat superheroes, even some of the lesser ones, is that they were just so different, both tactically and in terms of, especially with this one, in terms of their structure, to what would eventually become the standard. We get a lot of moments that would be formula later in this film, and we have the mishaps with the power, like when he's first learning to use it. We have the, you know, the big coming out when a citizen is in peril. We have the bad guy discovering the true identity and forcing the hero to give up his power to save the girl. That stuff is there. But Cliff gets discovered immediately. Like, his secret identity is only secret for about 12 hours. If you watch this movie, between the time he first shows up to save the pilot in distress and the time the bad guys know exactly who the fuck he is, it's about 12 hours.
Oh, so it's like a Raimi Spider-Man movie.
It's kind of like a Raimi Spider-Man. You know what it is? It's worse. It is an Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movie where he won't stop taking the fucking mask off. That's how many people immediately know who he is. And it to me, that was very interesting, because there wasn't this drawn out, like, trying to protect the identity. He is so focused on getting the things done that need to get done that the identity thing is the only reason his identity is secret is because of the helmet, which wasn't even intended to obscure who he was. It was intended to protect his goddamn head because he had a rocket on his back. So the emphasis upon, like, the duality is not there at all. Like, you don't really have those moments of, like, him trying to balance being a hero and having a regular life, because they're so intertwined that it just really made for an interesting, I guess, lack of dynamic. It's strange to say, but you didn't waste a lot of screen time on, you know, are they going to find out who he is? Is he going to be able to do? And then as soon as it's over, as soon as this adventure is done, he goes back to his old life immediately. He does not want to be the Rocketeer. Like, more so than, you know, Moody Spider-Man wants to stop being Spider-Man, or Moody Batman wants to stop being Batman by Act 3. No. He's like, I got to do this one thing, and then I'm giving this fucking thing back, because I don't want to do this. And then as soon as the story is over, he goes back to his life. And I was like, you know, that's not something we saw in a lot of, or any superhero movie, even of this period. And I thought that structure was really interesting.
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, this movie came out in 91.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about it is that it was in, I believe it was 93, that an exec at Disney had distilled down and written a memo about Monomyth, and distributed that memo at Disney, to which became the standard for storytelling at Disney. And once it became the standard there, it started bleeding out everywhere else. And Monomyth became something that we saw so often that now people consider it a non-story. You know, Avatar and Tron Legacy were both movies that were accused of having no story, even though they're structurally perfect Monomyth.
Yeah.
this was before anyone had distilled Monomyth for film. It was, you know, the people using Monomyth were, you know, people like Lucas and people like, wow, what is this? So Hollywood was still kind of in that concept of not having this pre-established, pre-drawn, fill-in-the-blank structure that became the norm for, you know, superhero movies. What you don't have in this is you don't have the refusal of the call, which you would see somebody be like, no, he has to deny being a superhero and then has to become a superhero. It's like, no, the minute he gets the rocket on his back, he doesn't want to fucking take it off.
Yeah.
Until the end, the refusal of the call is at the end. He's like, I don't want to be a hero anymore. I'm done.
Yeah. Well, it's all very pragmatic. It's like, I want to use this so that we can make the money back that we lost on when that plane crashed, because I just want to get to nationals. It's an entirely, it's not selfless, but it is not in the name of seeking fame. It's in the name of doing the other thing that you really want to do.
And they do something really cool in this that I love that you don't see a lot, and that you see in Great Adventure, but not something you see a lot these days. We have a villain who's a really bad villain, who were kind of cheering on at the end, because Paul Sorvino
is
an evil, fucking awful mob boss. The minute he finds out, now, and this is also one of the flaws of the movie as well, we'll talk about that, but the minute he finds out that the guy he's been working for is a Nazi conspirator, he's like, fuck you, I may be a bad guy, but I'm an American bad guy.
I love that line. I love that line so much.
It's so good.
I'm an American.
So goddamn good. And so all of a sudden now the G-Men and the mobsters are fighting Nazis.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
The problem I have with this is that the movie takes place in 1938, before there, you know, when there was still a big debate in this country as to whether anyone cared about the Nazis or not. So we were like, the Nazis are evil, they're doing awful things. And the other people were like, who gives a shit? We're staying out of it. Let Europe deal with Europe. And so the kind of that emotion that comes from that moment doesn't totally work, except that if you believe a guy's going to strap a rocket to his back and fly around, you may as well fucking believe that people hated the Nazis fully at that point too, and allow for a little revisionist history. But I love that moment. I love those kind of things. It's one of my favorite moments in any film, is when people who have been like bitter enemies for the entire film and done awful things to each other all of a sudden look at each other and go, there's an even bigger threat, and now we're badasses together. And there's a great moment where Paul Sorvino gives a look to a G-Man who he fought earlier in the film.
As they're both shooting at Nazis now.
They're both shooting at Nazis, and they have that look like, hey, what's up? And it's so fucking cool.
It's like when Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen as Professor X and Magneto stand side by side after how many previous X-Men films where they're fighting each other. No, I get it. I get it. But I also, I think this is as good a time
as any.
I think
it's more like when Tango and Cash.
Tango. Cash. I think we need to, and to address that, I think we need to talk a little bit about, one of my favorite things about this movie is how specific it is with all of, you know, I mentioned before all of these different things that it's nodding to in terms of the entertainment of the era in which it is set, and in terms of history, both actual history and lore. And they get so deep with some of their references that I kind of wanted to, as I was watching, I was kind of making notes and breaking this down. Obviously, we've talked about the fact that Neville Sinclair is based on Errol Flynn, and that Errol Flynn was suspected of being a Nazi. They even go so far as to have a scene in the, what is the name of that club, that undersea club that they go to? South Seas Club. So in the South Seas Club, as Cargill mentioned, there's a scene where he says hello to Clark Gable. That's not an accident. Clark Gable was Adolf Hitler's favorite actor. During World War II, Hitler offered a sizable reward to any of his soldiers who could capture Gable, who was fighting for America, and bring him to Germany alive and unscathed. So there's a reason. There's a reason in this movie that the Errol Flynn avatar is friends with Clark Gable. Okay, so that's point one. And again, like in that South Seas Club, there are so many affectations of 30s era celebrities that it is like those Looney Tunes episodes.
W.C. Fields
shows up and makes boob jokes at Jennifer Connelly. You know, there's apparently even, this blew my mind, there's an excise scene from the movie in which Neville Sinclair uses the actual freaking Enigma machine to send a message to Germany. The real thing that got the fucking Enigma machine. And that's what he was using to send messages. And then Disney went, nobody cares what that is. Nobody, but it's like, that's how.
Because in 1991, nobody cared.
Nobody did, because we hadn't made that Benedict Cumberbatch movie yet. And then.
Or that great fucking submarine movie that we talked about last year.
U-571, of course. What was I thinking? And the attention to detail.
During the reconnaissance.
And then there's the way that Cargill was mentioning the gangsters turning on Sinclair when they find out he's a Nazi. And yes, the timeline is a little murky. But there was the attitude in real life gangsters during this era. They did not like fascism. They hated Benito Mussolini, hated the guy. Like, that was part of the reason that they were doing what they were doing. And they moved to America and wanted to run their own show. They hated fascism. And then the Jewish mobsters obviously hated Adolf Hitler. So organized crime in history, like historically, turns out to be one of America's biggest allies to both government and law enforcement, to rooting out Nazi spies and collaborators.
Oh, yeah.
So even that, as silly as that moment is, as much as we love that silly moment, is still predicated upon something that happened in actual fucking history. And the thing that we're ignoring by even talking about that is why no one is surprised that there are Nazis on American soil. There's just like, Timothy Dalton says one word and an army of Nazis comes out of this park. And then there's a blimp in the sky with a fucking swastika. How did no one know about any of this? No one noticed at all. That's pretty terrifying to me. They just snuck in. Nobody knows what's going on. I don't have all borders covered pre-Pearl Harbor, but somebody had to notice that goddamn Zeppelin flying over LA, right? Come on. Somebody had to see that.
I'm pretty certain, actually, that the Nazis actually flew those with the symbol on it, and that was just, it was their national symbol, you know. It was like,
did they fly them over American soil though?
I want to say they did, and I don't know how much of that is
history and how much is the movie 1941.
How much is a number of movies?
Yeah,
like, I mean, you know, this is, there have been a number, a Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow did it too. And I'm not certain, but I want to say that that was actually a thing.
Yeah,
which is why that's come up so many times. But but I don't actually know. I just, at this point, I just want to believe it.
See, and that's what's so great about this movie, is that they're throwing so much fact, fiction, and fictionalized fact. I'm getting, like, I'm having a stroke.
Factionalized
fictionmenting. They throw so much of it at us that we don't even know what's real by the end. Like, I'm pretty sure America won World War II, but by the end of this film, I don't know for sure. Maybe
because the Rocketeer helped.
The Rocketeer, yes, because of America and flags. But there's a character in this movie called Lothar. This is probably my favorite weird reference of the whole movie. This is the actor playing Lothar was made up to look exactly like an actor, a B movie actor from the 30s and 40s named Rondo Hatton. He had and I'm going to mess up the name of this actual affliction, but acromegaly? Is that how you pronounce it? I'm not sure.
How the fuck would I know?
It's an abnormal growth of the hands, feet, and face caused by overproduction of the pituitary gland. So he looked very striking. He was one of the, kind of like a Richard Kiel type guy in the 30s and 40s. And I actually know this actor from a Mystery Science Theater episode where they skewered a 46 horror film called The Brute Man.
Oh, yeah.
So that's who, that's what I'm talking about. Like, that's deep track, nerdy reference taken to the extreme.
Oh, yeah.
That you're making your brute character look like someone who is famous in a very kind of tertiary way in the 30s and 40s for being that character. So that was my favorite thing, is that that's how specific this movie is, and how the attention to detail that Joe Johnston and the writer pays, and pulling a lot from Dan Stevens, who is also referencing a lot of things.
And that's what I love about this movie, is this movie doesn't exist in the 1930s. This movie exists in a 1930s movie.
Yes.
And in a 1940s movie. Like, it exists in the fiction of that era,
mm-hmm.
Only to exist in that fiction. It does, you know, it doesn't ever try to ground itself in reality, which is why it's such a wonderful adventure, but which is very much like, exactly what worked 10 years before with the Indiana Jones films, because the Indiana Jones films aren't really based, they're based in the serials of the 30s.
Right.
Which is essentially where this belongs.
Absolutely.
And this is that type of adventure film. And I hold this up there as among the very best of those callback adventure films.
And I think maybe it's the quality of the cast. Maybe it's the script, which, by the way, Frank Darabont did some work on.
Of course he did.
But there's even at its most, even at silliest moments, even when the humor should be falling the flattest, there's something so charming about every moment of this film, so endearing that you can't bring yourself to be cynical about it. I think it's a great barometer for how cynical your friends are. Show them The Rocketeer, and the ones that are just categorically dismissive of it are very, very cynical. Because I think it is incredibly difficult with the charm and the appeal and how endearing this movie is in every frame and how much work is clearly put into every frame of this movie. It's very hard, I think, to get cynical about it. And that's one of the reasons I think it holds up so well.
Yeah. But I don't think anyone would be really cynical about this particular movie.
I would hope not.
I mean, now that we live in the era of Marvel Studios, you know, this is a film that you will want to watch back to back with Captain America.
Absolutely.
Which is a very different film from its sequel, which is kind of what's so and stands to be apparently very different from the next one.
Like, yeah.
Each of the Captain America films are very different. But this one, Joe Johnston made two movies that fucking go together. And in a way that it's almost like The Rocketeer belongs in the early Marvel universe. Like, it is so perfectly realized and acted and structured. This is not a movie with any glaring flaws whatsoever.
No, even the effects, which are a little stuttery at times, they actually invented what is essentially the opposite of the Steadicam to use in this movie to kind of communicate the experience of that engine and its roaring. So it intentionally made things shakier. But even with that, the effects in this movie, even under the scrutiny of high definition,
yeah,
still hold up.
They still really hold up.
It's absolutely beautiful. And there are moments, I want to say this, there are moments in this film that remind me of the first Superman movie, the first Christopher Reeve Superman movie. Like, there's literally a scene where I have to believe that it was entirely an homage, where he's flying and he flies next to an airplane and there's a little girl that tries to tell her mom, like, hey, look, there's a man flying outside. I'm like, that's almost exactly like Lois Lane looking outside the train and seeing Clark Kent running alongside in the first Superman movie. So, I mean, there's that. There are
also, keep in mind that that Superman movie was hearkening back to this very same era.
There you go.
But what they were doing in those Superman movies was they weren't trying to invoke the nostalgia. They were playing with something that people had nostalgia for and updating it.
Mm-hmm.
While here, they were clearly going for the nostalgia rather than trying to update, you know, an old hero.
And I think that's interesting, too, the idea of referencing or paying tribute to other films, other works that in some ways are paying tribute to the same kind of sort, the same serials, the same kind of source material that this is. There's a character on that blimp that is almost identical to the Nazi with the glasses from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, wait a minute. No, there's no way that's accidental. That is almost the exact same character. So, yeah, there's a lot of little moments like that. And I think pulpery is going to be like the word that best describes it. It's pulpery. It's everything that was great about serials and about pulp comics of the 30s and 40s, given, you know, a treatment to make it fresh, and it everything works about it. And, you know, all of this, by the way, we didn't even mention, produced by Larry Franco, who produced almost all of John Carpenter's films up to, I believe it was Big Trouble in Little China. Like, a guy who's instrumental in getting the best fucking John Carpenter movies made. The team they had behind this film is remarkable.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's one of the reasons that this holds up so well. That being said, that brings us to a little segment, a new segment. It's something we've done a lot in the past. I'm just naming it now. Movies of Future Past. It's part of the show where we discuss the alternate timeline floating out there in the multiverse and the movies we know as they exist there. In summation, the movies that almost got made. Now, we've talked already about all of the actors who almost played Cliff Secord. Let's talk about some of the actors who almost played the other characters in this film. Apparently, Paul Sorvino was not the first choice for Eddie Valentine. He was the next person in line from the Goodfellas cast that would take the role because it was originally offered to Joe Pesci.
Oh, God.
Joe Pesci was going to, and I feel like that's like, you know what would not work about Joe Pesci playing this role is that moment we've talked about where they're fighting alongside the G-Men and you have that cute little like, oh, they're like buddies now. I would never believe that from Joe Pesci. I would believe that the next scene is as soon as the G-Man turns his head, Joe Pesci's going to stab him with the end of that gun until he is dead. Like, that would not, I would not
Although
buy that moment.
There's part of me that's like, I want to see, they fuck you at the Automat.
Let me tell you about the Automat.
You put the quarters in, and then the door won't open. It just won't fucking open.
Okay, whatever. Fuck it. I don't know, whatever. And then apparently, Peavy was, Alan Arkin was not the first person offered that role. Lloyd Bridges was the first person offered that role.
Which I think would probably be a better choice.
You think? I don't know about better. I think it would have worked. I love Alan Arkin, though.
He's so do I, but Doc Brown as Peavy.
No, not Christopher Lloyd.
Lloyd Bridges. I heard Christopher Lloyd.
Christopher Lloyd. Choice. Yeah, Christopher Lloyd would just be Doc again. Absolutely.
That's why the Lloyd stuck in my head and went, Christopher Lloyd. That's,
can you imagine a Back to the Future movie where Doc goes back to the 40s in L.A. and helps the Rocketeer, like, create the... Okay, yeah,
I'm halfway through writing it right now. I started just 3 minutes ago, and
damn
now
it.
it's already yeah no. Patent Lloyd pending. Bridges Patent not pending. As great a choice as Arkin, Christopher Lloyd. However,
yes, I'm just saying I like that. As far as Jenny Blake, Sherilyn Finn, Kelly Preston, Diane Lane, Elizabeth McGovern, Penelope Ann Miller, all considered for the role of Jenny Blake.
That's the who's who of who they were going
exactly,
after.
Exactly. Now, in the role of Neville Sinclair, this is kind of interesting, Jeremy Irons and Charles Dance were originally considered.
Both good choices.
Both very good choices.
Timothy Dalton, the thing about Timothy Dalton is he always had this great knack of being both heroic and good-looking and sleazy and just despicable at the same time.
He's the human equivalent of a pencil-thin mustache.
But the thing is like, you know, one of my favorite Timothy Dalton roles ever is as Baron in
Flash
Gordon.
Oh.
And you hate him so much. You hate him until the minute he joins the good guys and has that moment that we were talking about. And then all of a sudden, he's like fucking charming as fucking, you know, the aura, I've changed, you know, and you believe him. You fucking believe him. And it's all of a sudden from that point on, you're cheering him on. And every time he smiles, it's not sleazy anymore.
Yeah.
It's heroic. And he's got this great ability to turn that on and off at the drop of a dime. It's just he can go from without really changing expressions, but he can change he can change his own aura. It's amazing how
he can change his aura. I like that.
No, but you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
He can alter the way his charisma functions in a way to make you both to either hate him or love him. And so when he does that in this movie where all of a sudden he's he's bitching about, you know, this actress who has spoiled one of the 26th take. Mm-hmm. Of this thing, and then all of a sudden he's apologizing and inviting her out to dinner. There's not a question in your mind why this girl's going out with him. Like when he turns on that charm, you're like, oh, dude, of course she's going to go out with this guy.
Yeah,
like he's just so good at that.
It's oddly the charm that's missing when he plays James Bond. I actually like Timothy Dalton as James Bond because I think he's a great avatar of the book James Bond, of the James Bond that Ian Fleming wrote. But one of the things that doesn't work about him on screen is that while he's got the coldness, he's a man of action, all of that works, he doesn't take the time to be that charming, like exactly what you were talking about.
That's just it, is they were trying to get back to what essentially Daniel Craig finally nailed down.
Yeah.
That kind of Ian Fleming Bond. And really... the reason you get Timothy Dalton is because he's a great swashbuckling character.
He is.
Like, the fact that he didn't do more swashbuckling roles, like, because he really should have been an Errol Flynn in the 80s. We should have seen more, you know, more movies where he's, you know, the daring ne'er-do-well, pain-in-the-ass guy. Like, I almost want to see him in something like Pirates of Penzance.
Yeah.
As the Pirate King. Like, that's, I'm sure that must have happened on stage at some point, because most people in the early 80s played the Pirate King in Pirates of Penzance. But man, Timothy Dalton of that era would have fucking nailed that.
Instead, that shortly after this, he makes Beautician and the Beast, and things go awry.
Oh, why did you have to remind me that was a movie?
Because I always like to end the show on a good note, so...
Oh, thanks for that.
So, a couple of last things about The Rocketeer. I think every frame of this movie, every action sequence, it's all done so well, and it's so enjoyable, but at the same time, because of the attention to detail, because of how much love there is for, you know, the source material, for the source material's source material, every frame, every action sequence, it all works. Everything is pristine. Everything is exactly as it should be to make a movie like this work. There's so few missed notes in this entire film that I feel like it is far better than it has ever gotten credit for. And that kind of makes me sad.
Yeah, well, it comes from a weird movie, a weird era in Hollywood when you know, the wheels were kind of coming off of the major productions. And there was a reason why, you know, indie film just kind of took off and exploded the way it did. It was because people were kind of tired of the same old, and this was the end of that, you know, of this 15-year stretch of, you know, blockbuster movies that everyone was just kind of like, I'm kind of done. Like, this is where we're starting to get right now. Like, this era that we're talking about in Hollywood in the early 90s is what the next few years of Hollywood is going to be, and what we're kind of seeing right now, where all the things that have done so well for years are just starting to taper off, and people are like, this is all the same, and all of a sudden, you know, people are going to see, you know, a biopic,
right,
about rappers, you know, from 25 years ago, and all of a sudden, that's the big blockbuster movie, and Hollywood had no idea that was coming, and this is that era, and so the movies like The Rocketeer kind of fall by the wayside, and it's like, oh yeah, that's like The Phantom and Dick Tracy and The Shadow, right?
All movies I love, by the way,
and this is the good one.
This is the best one for sure.
This is the good one.
Not gonna take the bait.
You're gonna take that bait.
No, I will not.
You're gonna take that bait, Phantom Lover.
You think you're a master
baiter. You're gonna take that bait, Phantom Lover.
You are not the master baiter.
What does Billy Zane do? He punches evil.
Slams evil, god damn it.
You took the bait.
Fuck you.
You took the bait.
And you know what? You know what? Fuck you. That's all I have to say about that. I'm going to combine all of
that
your
skulls. I'm
going to remove your skull and get one of jade and one of silver. And God damn it, The Rocketeer is great.
And Treat Williams is going to hold it and fondle it.
You know what? Treat Williams is no Timothy Dalton. I will give you that.
I like it.
And that brings us inexplicably to the junk food pairing of The Rocketeer, which, again, that's...
Punches evil.
Slams evil! So I literally just broke the monitor. Hold on a second. He slams evil, god damn it.
Sucker.
The junk food pairing, I hate you so much. The junk food pairing this week is Beeman's chewing gum. At several points during the movie, Cliff's chewing gum, which is mentioned by name, the brand, several times, it becomes a major plot device. And again, this is owing to the commitment to detail of this movie. He is chewing Beeman's gum because... it was the lucky gum of pilots of the era. You actually also see this gum referenced in The Right Stuff, because it was actually the gum that pilots used to chew because they thought it was lucky, and they were a superstitious group, which I understand, because at this point in aviation, it's like, you got like a 1 in 4 chance of not dying when you go up there. So again, just like these little things all throughout the movie that really highlight how the specificity of Rocketeer helped it become elevated to something that has really stood the test of time and definitely is the reason we have, you know, movies like Captain America First Avenger, which was so instrumental in really pushing us into Phase 2 and beyond of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So Beeman's chewing gum, absolutely a junk food pairing. And that's going to do it for the show. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed it. You can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can follow us. Please do. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can also follow us individually on the interwebs. Cargill, for example.
You can find me at facebook.com/massaworm. That's M-A-S-S-A-W-I-R-M. Or on twitter.com/massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Briguy Salisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. Or you can hop over to oneofus.net, my home away from home. There's a lot of great geek blogs and podcasts for every taste out there, even for people who shit on the Phantom. And those people are
basically punch evil.
You know what? You know what? I may be a rapscallion. I may be a drunk. I may be an asshole. But what I am is 100% American, Cargill, and that means I like the Phantom.